All right, I'm going to try to just track these as we go, and I think this is only, we'll look at 6 of the 8 themes today. I don't think the other 2 come up. They might. We'll see. But I kind of want to give us let us know where we're at in the book right now. So we've had the prologue, which is John's words, and then we get the testimony of John the Baptist. He's testifying to who Jesus is, that Jesus is the Christ. John the Baptist himself is not. And he's doing what? He's pointing others, he's witnessing to Christ. He's pointing others to Christ, not himself. Today we're going to look and see who Jesus' first followers are. And it shouldn't be surprising that they are followers of John the Baptist. Because the best followers of John the Baptist are those who realize that Jesus is the Christ. And Jesus is the one who is greater than John. So we see how they respond. We get this initial response. There are no signs done. Jesus does kind of flex his supernatural knowledge a little bit and kind of impress Nathaniel. But aside from that, there are no signs done. We're going to begin to look at the 7 signs that Jesus does, starting with the turning of water into wine. Now, all the signs are going to do several things. They're going to show God's glory through Christ. It's going to reveal that glory of who he is. Also, they're going to indicate something about who Jesus is as the Messiah. Okay. And they also all, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but they also all will use the word at some point or another as the word sign. It will be included in there. Okay, because there are many things Jesus does. For instance, he walks on water, but when he walks on water, the word sign is not used. Also, it's not public. Nobody sees it. People hear about it, but nobody sees it. And it doesn't necessarily tell us anything about who Jesus is as the Messiah. It does tell us that he has supernatural abilities to be able to do this, that he has authority over the waters and things of that nature, but not necessarily who he is as Messiah. So we begin to see Jesus' signs, and these signs are all done to the Jews, okay? Because the first 12 books focus on Jesus' ministry to the Jews, not to the Gentiles, even though there will be some Gentiles in and out of the story. Now we begin with turning of the water into the wine, and then we see the next sign, and I want you in your mind, when you hear the word sign, to not think sign equals miracle. Sign does not always equal miracle. For instance, when Isaiah is walking around in the buff trying to tell Israel that they're about to be judged, it's not a miracle. But it is a sign indicating something about what's going to happen to Israel. So when Jesus clears the temple, he's not doing anything miraculous in this, as he did when he turned water into wine or when he heals people, but he is doing a sign. So we have miracles that do testify to the power and authority. We see Moses, for instance, doing sign and wonders to get the people out of Israel. And we also have prophets in the Old Testament doing signs, not in a miraculous sense, but in a sense to indicate something about God or judgment or something other. So Jesus is going to be doing signs, which do include both categories, but ultimately they all point to who Jesus is as Messiah. Well, we get varied responses, and this is important because this is where the chapter 3 really takes us, but we get varied responses. We see the disciples, they see his glory and what he has done, and they believe. We get the Pharisees who actually don't even see the sign and then say, hey, after he clears the temple, says, hey, what sign do you do to show us on what authority you do this, right? They've missed the sign, actually, ironically. But they don't believe. So we already have 2 divergent responses to who Jesus is and what he's doing. We have belief and we have unbelief. Now, the question is going to be asked, why do these people disbelieve? Why do some, when God the Son has come down, why do some refuse to believe? And why do some believe? And John's going to answer that through the discourse of Nicodemus. But right after we get the cleansing of the temple, right before the story of Nicodemus, we have this little small section, about 3 verses, where many people believe in the signs that Jesus was doing. Sounds good, right? Well, Jesus actually goes on, or it says that Jesus did not, it's really funny, the Greek, you see it better in the Greek because it's actually a play on words, and I appreciate a good pun like the next man. He uses a word called pistuo, so it says, and they pistuoed in him and his signs. So they believed in him and his signs, but he did not pistuo in them. He did not believe in them, but it can also be translated, here's where the play on word is, entrust himself to them. And that's the way your English translations typically take that. But they believed in his signs, but he did not entrust himself to them. Now, we have to ask, well, what's going on here? What's true faith? And we'll deal with that later. And then we get Nicodemus, and right before that it says, Jesus needed nobody to tell him what was in man. So Jesus knows the heart of man. So we have that word man. Chapter 3, verse 1 begins with, and there was a man from the Pharisees. So Nicodemus is, in some sense, a perfect picture or microcosm of all of humanity. And we're going to see Nicodemus, and ironically, Nicodemus is what? He's a Pharisee. He's a teacher of the law of the Old Testament. Okay? And Jesus is going to, he does actually call Jesus rabbi, but Jesus is going to show him that he actually, ironically, does not understand. But ultimately, his refusal to accept these things that Jesus teaches, because he's going to find them very hard, is not because he doesn't know enough, but because he willfully chooses to not believe. And Jesus also indicates to him that he needs to be born again. And then we're going to finish up with some commentary from John, and then we'll see a short section on John the Baptist where he indicates who he is in regard to who Jesus is and how, why he must necessarily decrease and Jesus must increase. So that's kind of where we're at right now. The main focus is going to be on belief and unbelief and why this happens. But it all is going to usually center around who Jesus is as well. So let's go ahead and jump in. And I'm going to kind of go fast through the rest of chapter 1 because we do need to move on. But we're going to see the first followers of Jesus. And again, these are disciples of John. And let's look in chapter 1, verse 35. The next day again, John was standing with his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And we've talked about this as probably speaking better than he knew, maybe referring to the passage of the lamb led to slaughter in Isaiah, but also probably it refers to, as maybe John the Baptist didn't realize, but to what? To the Passover lamb and Jesus' fulfillment of that lamb. So we're already getting kind of sacrificial language here that the Messiah must what? Must die. And this will kind of just keep being ratcheted up. The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. So John did the very thing he came to do, which is to point others to Christ, and it seems to have worked here. Jesus turned and saw them following and said, this is great, you've got to love Jesus the way he responds to people. I actually find John's gospel quite humorous, but so they turn around and follow me. He's like, what are you seeking? Like, why are you following me, right? What do you want to find? And I think this is a question mainly for us. What are you seeking as you read this gospel? What are you hoping and looking to find in this Jesus that you read about? And they said to him, Rabbi, which means teacher, it's a respectful term. They also called John the Baptist rabbi. Where are you staying? He said to them. Now, this is also, I think, an invitation for us. Come, and you will see. It's an imperative. Come, and you will see. So if you come, you can understand it, you will see. So it's an invitation for us to do what? To come, to taste and see that the Lord is good. So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. Now, by the way, I don't know if I said this last time, but beginning in verse 19, we have an ending in chapter 12, verse 1. We have a period of 7 days, which possibly also alludes to maybe some new creation kind of language after we get Jesus coming in, almost in new creation language coming into the earth. Now we have a 7-day period. Verse 19, we have the first day. Verse 29, the next day is day 2. Verse 35, day 3, the next day. And then here, right here, and this is not explicitly stated, but they came in the 10th hour, which is about 4 p.m. They counted their days. They didn't count the nighttime. They only counted from about roughly 6 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon, so daybreak to sunset. But anyway, so it's almost nighttime. If you're already out at this point, you really probably can't go home, especially if you live far away. So Jesus invites them to stay. So this would imply the fourth day. And then if you look in verse 43, we have day 5. And then verse 2, on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana of Galilee. So they count their days different than we do as well. They count what's called inclusively. So they count, so for instance, day 5 to day 7, we would say that's how many days? 2 days. 5, 6, 7. And this is how we're going to get a proper resurrection counting too, by the way. Friday, Saturday, Sunday being the third day. They're going to count day 5 was 1, even though it was almost spent. We're going to count day 6 that's not mentioned here, and then we get the third day, which is day 7. So actually, really interesting, we'll have a full week of activity, so Jesus' first week of ministry. And many people see allusions to new creation in that as well, but we make too much of that, I'm sure. All right, verse 40. One of the two who heard John speak followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. So one of these two was Andrew. He first found his own brother and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. Now, this is going to be a point of emphasis for in John's book, but this also gets us to how are God's people to live? What's our mission? And part of that is to do what? It's to witness to others. We must witness or testify that language, it's that courtly language almost of testifying, of witnessing, bearing witness about who Jesus is. And we're going to see many people that are brought to Jesus are brought by others, others' testimony. And we see this here with Andrew. So he brings them to Jesus, And Jesus says to him, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas." Now, interestingly here, right, he sees him and he renames him. Right? This reminds us of people in the Old Testament who are renamed according to a certain purpose. Think of Abram being renamed to Abraham. Also, it expresses authority, right? I'm taking authority to do what? To rename you. So it's in some sense a very divine thing here, right, to do this. Or authority that's been given. Think about Adam naming the creatures and parents naming their child. It's an authoritative act, right? My son can't one day say, I don't want to be called Isaac, right? I reject what you... No, my authority, place that name on him. So there's authority going on here too. Also, this is actually pretty common in this day and age for teachers to rename students. If I could, I would, but I might not have a job, but no, I'm just kidding. But teachers would rename students mainly for this purpose. In some sense, it seems to maybe show a characteristic about them or something like that. But I think Jesus is doing something different here. He's naming Peter, and Cephas, by the way, and Peter mean rock, okay? This solid thing, this dependable thing. He's naming Peter this. Now, we're going to follow Peter's story, and you know it from the other Gospels as well. Peter is anything but a rock, right? He wants to be a rock. He wants to be this reliable, sturdy thing, but what? He is a weak man. He says, "I will never, under any circumstances, leave you." And they come arrest Jesus, and he goes, and he does follow. He gets into the court where Jesus is being tried, and a little servant girl, among other people, scares him, right? So this is not a solid man in that sense. But when you get to Acts, what is Peter? He is a rock. He is solid. So Jesus names Peter according to what he will become, not what he is. So I think this is something about, it tells us about true faith, that God is going to make us into something. He's going to make us into something better than we are. He's not going to leave us where we're at when he saved us, but he's going to sanctify us and make us holy and make us into something like this. So we have Andrew and we have Peter and potentially the other disciple that came, maybe John, the gospel writer here, the evangelist. Verse 43. The next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said, "Follow me." Now, it could be that Jesus just walked up and found Philip and said, "Follow me." It could be also, because we're going to learn in verse 44, that Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. So Andrew and Peter may have known him, and they may have walking with Jesus, said, "It's our friend," or something like that, introduced him, and again, maybe brought him to him. If that's the case, everybody that comes to Jesus would have done so on the basis of someone else's witness. It's not clear. Regardless, Jesus does find him, and he says, "Follow me." And Philip does. Philip goes and then listen to this. So this is back to this idea of we must witness and bring others to Christ. What does Philip do? Philip found Nathanael and said to him, this is a pretty funny part here in a second, but "We have found him whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." So Jesus is the one whom the Old Testament prophesied about. So he's identifying him in this way. The Old Testament, and this is a way to say the whole Old Testament, the law and the prophets. Sometimes law, the prophets, and the writings are just shorthand law and the prophets. So the one that's been foretold in the Old Testament is here. We have found this one. Now, you got to love Nathanael's response. Now, I don't think we should necessarily see Nathanael as snarky or something like this. He's maybe just a discerning man, and he hears... He says Jesus of Nazareth, and maybe there's kind of, and Nathanael's also from a small town. It seems there may have been like some small town rivalries or something like that. But also, Nazareth is a small town of about like 2,000 people, which is about how big the place I grew up in was. So I understand a little bit where Nathanael's coming from. but anyway, it's a very small town, kind of a backwater place if you want to think about it like that. So people, I know when I grew up, I had to listen to all the people from Wilson County, for instance, say, "Oh, those country bumpkins in Smith County," and they just made fun of us, you know, sold us up and down the road. But anyway, so that's probably what's going on here. But nonetheless, the irony of this statement, listen to this, what he says, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And what's the irony? Yes, the Messiah, right? So we have an instance of Johannine irony there. And Philip said to him, now look what he says. He says the very same thing that Jesus said to Andrew and the other disciple, "Come and see." It's almost this exact same type of invitation. If you come, you will see. You will find. If you don't come, you will not see. And Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Now, Nathanael is going to be a stark contrast to the Pharisees, in whom there is deceit. Nathanael is going to come. He is going to eventually say, as we'll see in a second, that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the King of Israel. He doesn't have deceit in him, so he's not like who? Israel or Jacob, the deceiver, right? He is a true, a pure Israelite. Okay, there are going to be those in Israel who are like Jacob, the deceiver, who have reason, motives, for whatever they may be, to not believe. Okay, but there's none of this in Nathanael. He is a pure Israelite in this sense. And he's going to be a foil for what we see the Pharisees doing shortly after. Nathanael said to him, you've got to imagine he's a little bit astonished. How do you know these things about me? Jesus answered him, before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you. All right, this freaks you out a little bit, right? And he is astonished at this. Now, it was pretty common when somebody showed supernatural knowledge in the Jewish world to credit it somebody being a prophet or some kind of divinely sent figure. Also, even in the Roman and Greek world, somebody that had this kind of supernatural knowledge was taken to be maybe as a god or maybe as someone specially gifted or something like this. So this is common, maybe in some sense. And we'll see this with the woman at the well next week when Jesus tells her, you're right in saying you don't have a husband because the guy you live with right now is not your husband. And you did have five husbands before that. But regardless, right? He says all that to her, and she's like, you must be a prophet, which is a big understatement, right? But nonetheless, this is pretty common. So Nathanael does respond, and he's just been told that this is the one foretold. So seeing Jesus do this, and again, it's a very small thing in comparison to what he's going to do, but how does he respond? Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. Now, maybe we don't know exactly the depth to which he understands and believes these things. It does seem Nathanael later is going to ask Jesus about bringing the questions about the kingdom, if he's going to restore the kingdom and things later. So it doesn't seem like he has a full-fledged understanding of who Jesus is, but he does have a very good beginning. And this is something we see about true faith. We must act on what we know. That is, we must believe based on what we do know at the time. It's not as if we say, I don't fully understand all these things, so I'm going to wait until I become really steeped in them, have a PhD in them or something like that. But no, we must act on what we do have. So this is something we see of true faith. It acts on what it knows. And I think that's what we see from Nathanael here, and really all of the apostles at this point, because we know they're going to misunderstand things. They still don't have a category for a suffering Messiah, one who will die. It's why Peter rebukes Jesus when he says things like, hey, I'll be killed, and 3 days later I'll rise again. He's like, whoa, no, don't talk like that, right? And this is just after what? In Matthew's gospel, Jesus has just said, he's blessed Peter for his confession of him, right? Right after. So clearly they don't fully understand, but what are they doing? They are acting and they are believing based on what they do know. And that is leading them to a fuller understanding of that. So we have Nathanael proclaiming this high confession of Jesus. Verse 50, Jesus answered him, because I said to you, I saw you under a fig tree, do you believe? He's like, that little small thing, you believe just because of that, right? You will see greater things than these. I thought that was great. Just hold on, right? It's going to get much better, right? And the next few verses, we're going to see him turn water into wine. And then we're going to see him heal people later on in the book. So he's going to see much greater things. Verse 51. And he said to him, truly, truly. Now, truly, truly is going to be used over and over again. It's just kind of a way to say, attest to the truthfulness of what's being said. You repeat it. Hebrews typically repeated things in multiples. Holy, holy, holy. Trying to emphasize what? The holiness. So here too we have repetition of words trying to emphasize the truthfulness of it. Also, just as a fun fact, these words are what we get our word from, amen. So he's saying, amen, amen, something like that. So truly, truly. I say to you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Well, this should remind us of what? Of Jacob in the Old Testament when he is, and we've already talked about a true Israelite, a true person of Israel, true Jacob, with no deceit. Of Jacob's ladder, when the angels are doing what? When he's laying down, when the angels are coming from heaven's open, and the angels come down and up and back and forth, okay? And what does he call that place? Bethel, which is the house of God. The place where what? God's glory was manifest, okay? So Jesus, in some sense, is the fulfillment of this. And again, we have fulfillment, but it's also ratcheting up. He is the more perfect revelation of this. He is the true, as it were, house of God. The place where God's glory dwells and is manifest. We saw this in the prologue when we talked about Jesus coming and doing what? Tabernacling with us. The place where he would manifest his glory. By the way, Heaven's Opened is just a very kind of this apocalyptic type revelation from heaven. So I think in Ezekiel, the book opens, and what opens in the book when the book opens? The heavens, right? Heavens are open, and he sees this vision, this almost direct revelation from God. In Revelation, in chapter 19, John is going to see what? The heavens opened. Stephen, when he's being martyred, is going to see the heavens opened. Jesus, when he's baptized, is going to see the heavens opened. So it's just, as it were, a direct revelation from God to man. And it's in this time period, it's something that was longed for and sought for. But Jesus tells him he will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Okay, which this is his favorite self-designation, Son of Man. And I don't know if I said this last week, but Son of Man is from Daniel 7. You have this heavenly ruler, this one who looks like a son of man, comes down from heaven and to earth, and God gives him the kingdoms of the world, and all will bow down and worship him. And this is Jesus' most common self-designation, Son of Man. I don't think John, when John's narrating, ever calls him this. Jesus is the only one that calls himself this in this book, I believe. All right, so we've seen also, I should put this about Jesus, he is one, this will be very important later, one who knows the hearts of men. He knew what was truly in Nathanael. He didn't see his, what we might perceive as snarkiness or something like this, as such, right? He knew he was not one in whom there was deceit. He was a discerning man. He also knew what Peter could be. So he's able to foresee that and also bring that about. All right, now we get to some of the fun stuff. Not that the other stuff's not, but all right, we get to the first sign. Now, there are seven signs. This is the first one. In verse 11, we'll see the word sign. But this is the turning of water into wine. So let's look in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now, geography is important here. Chapter 2, verse 1, we begin with a sign being done at Cana. We will end what's called the Cana cycle in chapter 4, verse 54, when Jesus heals an official son back in Cana. So this is kind of bookended with the water into wine and then this act. So if that helps you to kind of know where we're at. So Jesus also, in between that time, is going to go to Jerusalem and then back, because we know he'll talk to Nicodemus. He'll clear the temple in Jerusalem. He'll talk to Nicodemus in Jerusalem. Then he'll go baptize in the provinces of northern Judea. So he's still in Judea, which Jerusalem is a part of. And then he'll eventually go through Samaria to return back to Galilee, where he'll talk to the woman at the well. And he'll go back to Cana, and he'll heal the official son. So we have kind of like Jesus going back and forth. John's gospel is the only one that shows Jesus doing these things. Matthew, Mark, and Luke picture Jesus as starting in Galilee and kind of funneling towards Jerusalem. Kind of this very intent march. What is Jesus doing? He is going to die. Now, John, many people have debated, or some concerned with history and others just concerned with themes or something like that. So many people think John takes all these things and puts them out of order. I think they're both concerned with history. They just have overlapping periods, some periods that aren't mentioned. So John does give us this kind of overlapping period where Jesus and John the Baptist are still ministering. It seems in all the other Gospels that Jesus' ministry does not begin until John the Baptist is in prison. Okay, but it seems like he was doing things before that, and there was a time when they were both baptizing concurrently. But anyway, so that's where we're at now. Now, Jesus has never done a sign at this point, because this first section is going to say this is his first sign. So he's not done a sign at this point. So he has not done what? He has not revealed his glory. Okay, that's going to be very key for what we see here following. So weddings back then, week-long events. You have to realize that we have a poor understanding of festivity and festivals in our day and age. We're too busy to have fun, to have a truly good time, right? Why? We have to be back at work. Work starts back at Monday and it goes. So, and by the way, when we hang out on Saturday and have a good time, everybody has to leave the birthday party after an hour, because why? You've got things to do, right? There's no, we don't have this idea of feasting because we're machines now. Not a good thing, but we don't need to get sidetracked. It'll be a fun topic to take up. But anyway, weddings were a week-long thing. Everybody came and had a good time. They enjoyed each other's company. It was a joyous occasion for the bride and for the groom, and these people were here to celebrate that with them. Part of friendship is what? Being there in the good times, celebrating these high moments in life. Now, this is expensive, right? The host was expected to, the groom, I get those mixed up. The groom was expected to provide wine for the whole week. Okay. It's not just like 10 people coming. You're talking about like the many people in the village are going to be there, right? And depending on where you live, it could be a lot. Extended family are coming, right? Jesus, for instance, and his mom are from Nazareth. This is in Cana, right? Maybe they're relatives of the bride and groom or one of the two, and they've been invited. So you've got a lot of people here, and you're expected to provide wine for that entire week, okay? That's a lot. That's expensive. Just think about the cost. Okay, I mean, think about planning a wedding now for one afternoon for one meal, right? It's a lot more than that in some ways. And I'm sure others would help out and things like this. It was also a social faux pas to run out of wine. It was a no-no. You don't run out of wine at the wedding, right? It brings shame and even sometimes legal ramifications. You could be sued for running out of wine at your own wedding, right? So this is why you don't invite Uncle Joe, right? You know, you're like... I could have swore we mailed your invitation, right? But you drink too much, Uncle Joseph. You're not coming or something, right? All right, so that's kind of what's going on. So this is a big issue. And maybe would be helpful if we see maybe Mary and Jesus being related to the couple that's married or maybe the groom. Because Mary, in some sense, feels impelled to do something about this. So she goes to Jesus. Now, Jesus has never done anything like this. So I don't think she expects Jesus to do a miracle. What I do think she expects, and by the way, we've not heard reference of Joseph. The last time we heard reference of Joseph in the Gospels was when Jesus was 12 years old. Okay, so it's very likely, and church tradition holds that that Joseph died and Mary was a widow. So she relied upon her eldest son, Jesus, to provide. So she's probably just relied upon her son in many cases and knows that he's maybe industrious and able to do things. So she goes to him and says, hey, we're out of wine. Now, maybe the wine was, there's men's quarters, women's quarters, and also another social faux pas, no-no, was kind of integration, right? You didn't go just talk to the men and things like this, and men didn't go talk to the women, vice versa, in these kind of public settings. So, Mary maybe does go to Jesus, kind of maybe even breaking with that tradition, because she knows maybe Jesus can do something about it. Now, and maybe the wine was kept in the women's quarters or something like this. They have no wine. Jesus said to her, now listen to this response. Like, this is really hard to understand what to do with. Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. Many reasons that this is like hard to understand. First of all, why does he call her a woman? Is that disrespectful? Seems like to me, but it's Jesus. He wouldn't be disrespecting his mother, right? You know, so that's hard to deal with. And then the next, what does this have to do with me? And in the literally, here's what it says, is what to you and to me? It's an idiom, which essentially means something, I guess, like this is the best way to, what does this have to do with us? Right? What does that have to do with you and with me? Okay? And then the next part, my hour is not yet come. Like all three of those things just, you know, beg the question, what are you talking about? Right? So let's just take them one by one. We must remember that Jesus, while he is the Son of Mary, he is most importantly the Son of God, the divine Son. He is God himself incarnate. Come to do what? To reveal his glory. Okay? Keep that in mind as well. Woman is not necessarily as it is. If I said this today, that's pretty offensive. I said, woman, you know, whatever. That would be offensive. Right? It's like smack worthy, right? This is not the way it's taken back then. It's not polite. It's not impolite. It's kind of in this middle area. Okay? But what it's doing is distancing Mary from Jesus. As if to say, you must remember what? You are a woman. I am the Son of God. Right? So, I know that in one sense you're my mother, but in another sense, you're a woman, a person, right? I am God. So it's a distancing of themselves, okay? Almost, let's properly understand the true relationship. It's not disrespectful. It's kind of a polite pushback, if you want to think about it like that. What does this have to do with me? And that's just a question. Why are you involving me? That type of thing. Next, and this is the weirdest part, because Jesus' hour, something's going to come up again and again. And what Jesus' hour or Jesus' time referred to is his death on the cross. Okay? And for John's gospel, this is why. This is important. Jesus' time on the cross is his time for exaltation, ironically. The being lifted up as being exalted is also his what? Being lifted up on the cross. It's kind of does double duty there. So his hour refers to that. But he says, my hour is not yet come, but you have to ask, how does this have anything to do with Jesus' hour? Okay, what does this have to do with Jesus dying on the cross? Well, What Jesus is going to do is to do a sign, okay, which reveals his glory. He's never done one at this point. But what he's trying to tell her is, listen, woman, it is not your place to tell me when, and it's not disrespectful, but it's not your place to tell me when I will do a sign, when I will reveal my glory. I will reveal my glory when the Father tells me. Okay, because Jesus is the obedient Son. Okay, now, again, we need to, in some sense, exalt Mary as the mother of Jesus, but we can't go as far as the Roman Catholic Church and hold her as this kind of paradigm of holiness and sinlessness and things like this. She needs to also learn her place. This is not disrespectful, but she needs to understand that she has a place that is not equal to that of God the Father in Jesus' life, in some sense. So only God will tell Jesus, God the Son, when to reveal his glory by doing a sign. Okay, so does that make sense? Okay, so it's not disrespectful. It's not overly warm or something like this, but it's saying, listen, this is who I am. I will do this on my accord. Because we got to remember, nobody makes Jesus lay down his life. This is maybe a parallel thing. Jesus lays down his life of his own accord and his own will. Nobody takes it from him. He lays it down. Same thing here. Nobody makes him reveal his glory. Only he chooses to, being the sovereign God. Okay? All right, now let's look at what Mary's response is. His mother said to the servant, this is also a little puzzling too, do whatever he tells you, right? It seems like what? You know, he's not going to do it. And she's like, he's crazy. I don't know. Just do what he tells you. If he tells you anything, I don't know. It's a little strange, but she nonetheless seems to express something like, now I don't think we need to see it as faith in the sense of faith that Jesus is going to do some miracle, Jesus, the Son of God, but faith in what? That he has in the past been industrious and done things. Whatever he tells you to do, he's a smart guy. He's been helped me out in situations before. All right, now we get to the miracle itself. Now, there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, holding 20 or 30 gallons each. Now, so you have these stone jars that are quite large, 20 to 30 gallons. Now, what are they used for? They're used for purification. So when things were unclean or to make things clean, what you would do is you would immerse them in the water, right? So these jars, you had a bunch of people there. You have these jars used for purification. Does that make sense? Last week, we did talk about this, too, in regards to people. You have the group living around the Dead Sea, known as the Essenes, who live in the village of Qumran. And what they would do is they would actually self-immerse themselves. So they would, if they felt like they were, because they were really concerned with purification, and they were Jews, they were really concerned with this. And what they would do is if they felt sinful, they would immerse themselves, not somebody else doing it, they would self-immerse in water to do what? To cleanse themselves. Okay. So you have that same thing too. If you have items that are clean or unclean, you could dip them in this water for purification. Make sense? Now, they are for the Jewish rites of purification. And how many of them are there? And I do think this is important. There are only six, which is so the incompletion, the imperfection of it. So in some sense, this is to show that these Jewish rites, or old Judaism, is what? It's incomplete. It's insufficient. It's lacking. It doesn't mean it's bad, okay? But something greater is now here, and the old must necessarily pass away. Think John. John's going to say this later. I must decrease, he must increase, right? So it's not that the Old Testament was insufficient, bad, and we should be like, oh, it's all that law stuff or something like that, right? No, it was grace. But now something better is here, God himself. A better tabernacle's here. A better Jacob's here. Now, a better system of purification, if you think about it like that's here. All right, so you have these six stone water jars. Now, Jesus tells the servants, fill the jars with water, and they fill them up to the brim, so they fill them all the way to the top. Now, draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, become wine, so the water has become wine, and did not know where it came from. The servants who had drawn the water knew. So we could also call this miracle, or this sign, I almost said miracle, this sign as what? Semi-public, right? It is public, as all the signs are, but not everybody at the event knows, but some do. The servants know, but the chief of the festival does not. The master of the feast called the bridegroom, well, we'll get in that in a second. I do want to point out one funny thing, just because it's reading different things about what people are interpreting. Some people say that he didn't turn the water into wine, but because the word for verb for draw out, they argue, or at least one person did, is only used in reference to drawing from a well. What he actually did, it's crazy, turned all the water in the well to wine. So they had this huge like reservoir of this wine or something. But other people point out, no, there are examples where this refers to maybe drawing wine out of a cask or something like that. It's not always drawing out of a well. I found that humorous. You get some pretty funny interpretations. Nonetheless, these 6 stone jars of turned water. Now, you need to realize this too. This is an absurd amount. Okay, this is a lot. All Jesus' miracles are going to, in many ways, be doing this. They're going to be showing Jesus doing something, but not just like, oh, here's enough wine, or here's a few bottles or something like this, or maybe one jar. No, six. It's like 120 to 180 gallons of wine, okay? That's a lot, okay? He's going to heal a man that had been born blind. He's going to heal a man that had been paralyzed for 40 years. Not just somebody who'd recently, but it's like this long time. He's always been this way. Does that make sense? So his miracles are always going to be these kind of escalated things, not just little things, but huge things. So here, too, we have this, and it's important, we have an abundance that's very important, as we'll see in a second when we connect it to the Old Testament. Now, let's listen to what the head festival chief says. It's a good way to call him. All right, he said, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." So this wine is not only a lot of it, it's actually really good. Okay, the quality is better. The quantity and quality are greater and better. Okay, this is important. Just hang with me. So he kind of like, this is not according to our custom. We usually give the good wine first. Many reasons. And does the verb here, I think it's translated here, people have drunk freely. Sometimes it's translated have become drunk. I don't think we should look at this as some kind of raucous party. But nonetheless, we do have alcohol. Sometimes you do run the risk of people drinking too much, regardless. So I don't think we should view these weddings as raucous parties or something like this. Clearly, moderation was the norm. But nonetheless, even let's just take the people that do drink too much. They're not going to necessarily care for quality at that point, right? They just seem to want more, right? They're not concerned with that. But regardless, even if that's not the case, your tongue is more attuned to taste, wine, whatever it is, coffee, it doesn't matter. Even yesterday I was drinking coffee and this lesson came home to me because I'd roasted my own coffee and it was the first day and, oh, it's so good just the day after when you roast it. It's so fresh. And my first 2 or 3 cups of it were just wonderful. And then toward the end of the day I drank some more of it and it was like, I really can't taste what I tasted earlier, right? My tongue in some sense had become overwhelmed by the taste and things like that. So I couldn't taste. So regardless, you give the good wine first because later people are less discerning of quality at that point. Now, verse 11, and we'll kind of go back and recap with some Old Testament. This, the first of his signs, so that's the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee. And listen to this. "And by doing this, he manifested his glory," which is what he's coming to. These signs reveal his glory. And we also have the word that this is a sign. And now listen to the response, the proper response. "And the disciples believed in him." Now, remember that because we'll come back to that in a minute. Now, let's look at some Old Testament passages. Because we need to understand, well, what does wine have to do with this, right? Maybe it makes us uncomfortable in some ways, but I think if we understand the Old Testament language about wine, I think it will make this imagery a lot better. So you can look in Isaiah 25. We'll look at 3 places briefly. Isaiah 25, verse 6. Now, chapter 25 is talking about, as your heading says, when God will swallow up death forever. So it's talking about what? The end of times, in the last days. And verse 6 says, "On this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all people a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine." Excuse me. "Of rich food full of marrow and aged wine well-refined." So the idea here also is the quality of the wine is good, it's aged and it's well-refined. So the last day, the Messianic age, is going to be what? This age of well-aged wine. What should we see with this? Wine is kind of symbolic in the Old Testament of joy, right? The joy that God gives. Now, let's keep looking because there's many places it's talked about. Look at Joel 3. You have to give me a second to find it, too. Right, Joel 3, verse 1, and then verse 18, sorry. We'll actually come back to Joel 3 later. Verse 18. And this is talking about, because chapter 3 begins with, "In that last days, in those days, at that time I will restore to the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem," so the restoration of the kingdom. Verse 18. "And in that day, the mountains shall drip sweet wine, and the hills shall flow with milk, And all the stream beds of Judah shall flow with water, and a fountain shall come forth from the house of the Lord and water the valley of Shittim. All right, then let's look at Amos 9, so just the next book over. And we'll look in verse 13 and 14. Verse 11 is again talking about the restoration of Israel. In that day I will raise up the booth of David that has fallen, or repair its breaches. Now, going down to verse 13 and 14. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the treader of grapes, him who sows the seed. The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it. I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel, and they shall rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink their wine, and they shall make gardens and eat their fruit. So, in light of this Old Testament context, this sign is done. Now, the age of the Messiah is going to be, you could say, an age of wine, in the sense of what? This joy that's coming. This joyous age that's coming. So when Jesus is turning this water into wine, he's doing what? He is literally, in some sense, making this absurd, abundant amount, making what? The hills run with wine, in some sense. This alludes us back to what the Messiah is doing. So the Messiah and Jesus here is bringing in what? This kind of age of joy. This new age, okay, signified by wine here. And this is what this is getting us back to, about who he is as the Messiah. So he is the Messiah, the ushering in of this age, signified by the mountains running with wine, etc. So that's kind of the Old Testament context there. And that's the first sign that Jesus does. Now the proper response to this is to believe. Okay, and his disciples see his glory and believe. Now, and we'll talk about true faith versus false faith in a second. Any questions about that? I feel like that may be a little confusing or a little difficult at times. Okay, let me see here on themes. Well, let's look at the next miracle then, or next sign, even I can't. But, all right, the next sign, verse 13. We're going to go quick. So I'll summarize. Jesus comes into the temple. He sees people changing money, and they're probably changing money for the temple tax. For people that came in, they need to change their currency. Also, people are selling animals for sacrifices. It's a good service, a kind service, but it's being done in the temple. Now, just very, very briefly, you had the temple complex proper with the temple itself, and then you had kind of the outer court, and there was the whole temple complex would be this whole thing. This was a dividing wall, and only Gentiles could come in, okay? It's going to be important. So, and we see this from the other gospel accounts. But so the Gentiles could come in, but they could not go past this. Maybe this is what Paul's talking about when talking about Jesus has broken down the dividing wall of hostility. Could be what he's alluding to. But nonetheless, they are selling the animals in this area. So they are obstructing what? Gentile worship. And God's house, as the synoptics will tell us, and when Jesus clears the temple, is to be a house of prayer for all nations. So it seems there's this obstruction here. Now, John puts a temple clearing at the beginning, the synoptics at the end. I'm just going to, because of time, I think the best way to take it is there were two. Jesus did it at the beginning of his ministry and at the end. Many people, the other probably most common view is that there's only one and it occurred at the end. John took it and put it at the beginning for thematic purposes. I think the best way to take it is there were two. Maybe we can talk about that another day. All right, so he drives them all out. He drives them all out, showing zeal for the house of the Lord. And he says this, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade. So we see Jesus being concerned with holiness and the purity of worship. But what do his disciples learn from this? His disciples remember, and it doesn't tell if that's right now or later on. A lot of the times they remember things after Jesus has been raised. They remember that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Now this is a psalm of David where he is suffering at the hands of his enemies. The reason he's suffering, it seems to be, is that he is having zeal for the Lord's house and for proper worship in his own life and others. So it consumes him. Now, this is interesting here, too, right? This consumes in the sense that fills him up with it, right? But also, Jesus having zeal for his house will do what? Literally consume him, kill him, right? It's kind of this illusion as well. And this is the sign. The second sign is the clearing of the temple, okay? Now, a couple other places. You can write these down. I'm just going to read what I've written down here. But Zechariah 14:21 and Malachi 3:1-3, they both talk about the last day, or the final day, and the day of judgment. And here's what they say. There shall no longer be a traitor in the house of the Lord of hosts on that day. And the Lord will come to his temple, and he will purify the sons of Levi, and they will bring offerings and righteousness to the Lord. So in that last day, there will be no more what? kind of traders, merchants in his house, kind of profaning worship. He's going to do what? He's going to cleanse and purify the sons of Levi so they make what? Pure offerings. So this event also would seem to allude us to this, because again, the Messiah is coming in the last days. So Jesus is that one that does what? Clears and cleanses the temple, okay, so that proper worship can be restored. Now, that was the sign, but listen to what the Jews say in verse 18. So the Jews said to him, "Which sign do you show us for doing these things?" And the irony here is what? Just did the sign, right? It's a very authoritative act of what? Judgment as well. It's standing in the place of God, judging them. But they ask for a sign. What does Jesus do every time they ask him for a sign? He doesn't give them one. Jesus answered them. Now he's going to kind of explain the significance of what's happened. And again, they're going to misunderstand. And this provides maybe a little bit of humor. "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And the Jews said, "It has taken 46 years to build the temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. This is interesting and very important for us. Going back to chapter 1, verse 14, the prologue, Jesus came and tabernacled with us. He revealed his glory to us. And the place where God reveals his glory is the tabernacle and then the temple. Okay. Now, the temple, just like Judaism, just like those things of purification, just like Jacob, were great and good and gracious acts of God, but something greater is here. The temple was wonderful, but Jesus, the true temple, is here. So we see Jesus now saying and identifying himself with what? The temple. His body is the temple. And if you destroy this temple, if you kill me, okay, what will happen? I will raise it up in 3 days. So we also have an allusion, a foreshadowing to the death and resurrection. We also have strong identification with what? Jesus is the temple. Now remember when we talked in the introduction, it seems that this is written after 70 AD when the temple is destroyed. So for those Jews trying to pick up the pieces, as it were, John is giving them hope, saying what? Listen, the temple was great, but now the true temple, the fulfillment of the temple, is here. And if you would properly worship, you must believe in Christ, the true temple. If you would like to meet God where he is most perfectly at, then you must meet him in his Son. We could meet God in the temple, in some sense imperfectly, but now the Son, who was from all eternity with God, who is from above, has come down and revealed himself to us in the person of Jesus Christ. So that's what the temple, the cleansing of the temple symbolizes. He's this end-time figure who will come in the last days, if you're writing under the themes of who Jesus is. He's authoritative judge. He is the one who will die and be raised. So we're already getting this language of suffering Messiah. He's zealous for proper worship. And he's the fulfillment of the temple, the one whom all men should worship. Next, we get this really interesting passage in 23 through 25. "Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name. When they saw the signs that he was doing," so many people see these signs and believe. But listen to this, "but Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people." So again, we go back to this, Jesus knows the hearts of men. So he knows and he discerns what? That this belief they have is not what? Genuine and real. But it is based solely upon what? The doing and repetition of signs. When the signs cease, as we'll see in John chapter 6, you get all these people, the Jews, following Jesus, and he says some pretty audacious things like, "Eat my flesh, drink my blood." And they're like, "That's a hard saying. You're being serious." And they keep clarifying, "Yes, he is." And they go away. Okay? So it's very hard. So this belief that we have here is shown to be spurious. It's shown to be false. Okay? Because it's not in who. It's not in the person. Okay? The signs point back to what? The glory of the person. Now, if we're just believing in the signs, even though they do reveal his glory, and that's it, then we've fallen short. We worship the thing, as it were, maybe you could say, of the creation rather than the what? The creator himself. Okay? We must do what? We must worship Christ because of who he is. It's not enough to just say, "There's this really awesome guy who did a lot of really neat signs. Let's see another one, and I'll keep believing in him." But no, this is the Son of God. This is the Messiah, and we must believe in him. Verse 24. "But Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people. And listen to this, and needed no one to bear witness about who? About man. For he himself knew what was in man." Verse 1 of chapter 3. "Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus." Okay, see that connection? So who's the paradigm for this group? Nicodemus. He is a man whom Jesus knew all about, knew what was in his heart. And you'll see that by the way Jesus kind of addresses not his words, but his heart. And Jesus is going to do this with the woman at the well. He has supernatural knowledge of what is actually going in their heart, what their true motives are. So when Nicodemus comes, when the woman at the well, when he meets her, he knows what's in their heart. And he addresses that, not necessarily what they say. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. So you have a teacher of the people, a leader of the people, okay? Somebody who had been very concerned with personal holiness, okay? Somebody that we could probably look at and say, this is a very good man, okay? Contrast this with the woman at the well, who is an adulterous, sinful woman, right? You have the two contrasts there. Who also lacks knowledge, because being a Samaritan, she didn't have the full revelation of God. They had a version of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, but a deficient version at that. So she didn't fully understand. Jesus is going to tell her that as much. All right, so he comes to Jesus. Now listen to his language. Very flattering language, maybe sincere, very kind, but short of the mark. Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one does these signs that you do unless God is with them. Now, the plural we there could be he's got a group of his own followers with him, and I just imagine like one of the dance movies like Step Up or something like that, and they're coming with their dance crews. Like, you know, we believe that you... That's what I see in my mind anyway. But nonetheless, he comes to Jesus. Now, it could be also that he's saying we in representation of he and the other Pharisees. Okay, so we know these things. We know that you are a teacher come from God. Why? Because you do these signs. So he believes that you are some divinely sent prophet, or maybe or something in other words, and we know this because of what you do. Nobody who's from God or who not from God does these things. He also calls him rabbi. So you're a good teacher, you're a miracle worker, you're a powerful man, you're sent from God. But what does he fail to acknowledge? Jesus is the Christ, that he's the Messiah. So though his words are very flattering and better than many, they fall short. Now listen to what Jesus says. He doesn't say, well, thank you very much, you know, I've done a few nice things here and there, right? Here's what he says. And it's just almost absurd. Like, you got to love Jesus because he knows what's going on in the heart. And he addresses these things that seem to, it's like when you've been around somebody that really knows how to counsel people really well. You're just kind of telling them stories about yourself and talking, and all of a sudden you're like, I never told you that. How did you know that, right? It's because the Lord has gifted them, and they've also trained to do this. But Jesus has a leg up on all of us, right? He has supernatural knowledge, so it's a little different. Truly, truly, he's going to answer his questions three times, but truly, truly. I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Okay, so hey, you're a great teacher. We know you're from God. Truly, truly, you cannot see the kingdom of God unless what? You're born again. Okay, now the language is a little ambiguous. Born again could be translated born above. So I think that's important too, and we'll see that later. So born again and born above. Just hold on to that for right now. Nicodemus said, and here again is this Johannine misunderstanding. How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born? And clearly the answer is no, right? He doesn't understand, right? So it's ironic. The teacher of the people is what? Needing to be taught by one who is presumably younger than him, right? Because Jesus has been in his early 30s here. Now, Jesus is going to respond by what he means. We had the first statement. One is can't see the kingdom of God unless he is born again, okay? He's going to clarify. Like, okay, when you're a teacher and people don't understand, what do? Usually, you say the same thing in different words. That's what he's going to do next. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. Now, many have taken this idea of water and spirit to be, unless you're born physically, water being something like related to amniotic fluid or something like this, unless you're born physically, and then you're then later spiritually reborn, so you have two births right there, unless both of those things happen, you can't enter the kingdom of God. Well, that's true. That's not what's in vogue here. It's a parallel statement. Okay, born again or born from above is parallel to what? Born of, parentheses, two things, and they're included, and we'll talk about what they mean, of water and of spirit, okay? That's the same thing as saying being born again, okay? So that's one envisioned there, even though the second one uses two words, is how many births? One birth, same thing, okay? Because later he's going to say there's a birth of the flesh and there's a birth of the spirit. Later we'll get that distinguishment. But birth of the spirit, one way you could say it is be born again or from above. The second way is to say what? Be born of water and spirit, okay? Makes sense? All right, let's just briefly, not enough time in the day, right? I'll stop there, and I'll leave you hanging with wanting to know what that Old Testament allusion is about. All right, you guys are dismissed.